You're welcome back to The Late Debate with Cormac O'Hara. Joining me in studio this evening is Deputy Stephen Donnelly, Independent TD for Wicklow and East Carlow, Professor Alan Barrett of the ESRI and the IFAC, the Fiscal Advisory Council, Senator Aideen Hayden, Labour of Labour and a member of the Threshold Housing Agency, and Senator Mark McSharry of Fianna Fáil. You can contact the programme by text on 51551, email latedebate@rte.ie, and you can follow us and engage on Twitter at Late Debate RTE. Well, he said, "I'll never make a more important announcement." That was Minister Alan Kelly today as he unveiled the government's housing plan. You heard some of the detail there in the bulletin. They've promised 110,000 new homes, 35,000 social housing units by 2020. 3.8 billion euro in funding is being made available. Aideen Hayden, before we get to the nuts and bolts of this, why was there a need to re-announce this again today? Did we not hear a lot of this in the budget?
We did hear some very positive announcements in the budget. There's no doubt about that. There was 2.2 billion announced. But this actually, this announcement goes beyond what we heard in the budget. And it is a strategy to cover the period from 2015 to 2020. And I think...
Is it a strategy or just a fleshed out version of what we heard in the budget?
No, I actually think it's a strategy. It's a lot more developed. It's a lot more nuanced. It's a lot more to say. But the way,
I suppose why Fianna Fáil and the likes of Mark McSharry are disconcerted by this and calling it a PR exercise is that we've had major announcements this week, and it's only Wednesday, on broadband, on medical cards, on state boards, and now on social housing. You'd swear, Aideen Hayden, you're trying to divert attention away from something else.
No, I think it's been very clear that this announcement on social housing has been coming for a long time. It's been in the pipeline. It's been, you know, there's been discussions at the upper echelons of government to discuss this. Because I think, you know, Brendan Howland said, and I fully believe he is correct, that housing is the biggest issue facing this government. And I think it's been given the time and the attention that deserves at the highest echelons. And yes, now we have a strategy, and I think it is a strategy.
Okay, and before we get to the meat of it, what do you make of Fianna Fáil's criticism then that is simply a PR exercise?
Well, look, if I was sitting where Mark McSharry was, I'd be saying exactly the same thing.
Mark?
So I don't take that seriously.
No, listen, I have the height of respect for Aideen, and indeed her track record in housing is more than anybody else in the studio, and indeed most in Leinster House in terms of the knowledge of what needs to be done and so on. But look, I do have that concern. I do have concern that, look, where are the tangible actions here? You know, where is the list that says, there's the 26 counties, these are the local authorities, this is the capital programme we're engaging into, and this is how many houses are going to be built? I have real concerns about the private sector's intention to get involved with government on this. Outside Dublin, the cost of building is still considerably more than what one can purchase a house for, and I don't think there'll be a queue of builders to build for the kind of prices that government have in mind. The other thing is, there's a huge amount of unused stock all over the country that seems to be ignored by government and local authorities. Why don't we get those into action, either in terms of making them available to tenants and writing off rent in the future against upgrading them themselves, just as a matter of using stock that's available. And indeed, there are many local authorities throughout the country.
Okay, and you have major concerns. Stephen Donnelly, do you have concerns about this?
Well, first of all, Cormac, look, credit where credit's due. Is this a relaunch of what was announced on Budget Day? Well, maybe it is. But if it's a 3.8 billion euro programme for housing, well, let's announce it. God knows we spend an awful lot of time talking about bad news. So fair play to the government. Like, I wouldn't begrudge them having a big announcement on that kind of spending at all.
But is there a need to re-announce stuff?
Well, why not? It's good news. It's great. It's bloody good news. I mean, it's nearly four billion.
They could be accused of propaganda by re-announcing stuff that they've already announced weeks ago.
No, I don't think so. I mean, the budget contained an awful lot of things. It was complex. It contained expenditure, taxation, all sorts of bits and pieces. This is a major programme. I am concerned. Was it Peter McVerry we heard in the clip?
Yeah.
I am very concerned to hear that clip, because he, and I agree with Mark, Aideen knows an awful lot about this. Peter McVerry knows an awful lot about it too. And if he is as unhappy as he was in that clip, well, that causes me concern. The devil will be in the detail. But like,
have you seen the detail?
No.
And you're not concerned that this is being re-announced again? You say it is a strategy, but you don't see the detail. I heard you on this week during the week complaining about Irish Water, saying that we still don't have a financial plan.
Yeah.
But now, when it comes to this, you're happy to row in even though we don't have detail.
Well, no, hang on. What I'm saying is you seem hung up on the government having a launch on it.
Having detail.
What I'm saying is we get an awful lot of bad news from government. This is, the devil is in the detail, and we will get into the detail. But as a large building programme, why not at least stop and say, thank God something is happening? For the last 4 years, Cormac, government policy has made it worse. The mortgage to rent scheme didn't work. They refused to fix it. Rent caps kept coming down. Support got pulled from homelessness. A lot of bad stuff happened.
Okay, well, let's get into the details.
Just finish by saying, now, finally, I hope in year four that this is the beginning of a turn, and it is the start of some good news for the very serious housing challenges.
Before I bring in Alan Barrett, Aideen Hayden, let's get into the detail right now. Why is Labour, or is Labour, a Labour minister, Alan Kelly, handing the bulk of social housing policy over to the private rented sector?
Well, I mean, first of all, I'm just going to backstep a little bit here. You say there's actions, but there are many actions in this document I have before me. In fact, it's rich with actions. So maybe we could have this debate on at a time when we've all had a chance, all of us have had a chance to go through this. And I know Mark probably hasn't. There are specific actions in this programme, and they're very good actions.
And we'll come to those. But just a question.
No, can I just finish this point? Because I think it is important. There's a point being made here that the government have not given this a lot of consideration, that there's no flesh on the bones. I think there's a lot of flesh on these bones. In the budget, 2.2 million was announced. There's billion. There's 3.8 billion being announced today. There's a very significant ramp up of government expenditure on housing policy. Again, this document is very, you know, it's like asking me for a one-line answer on where, you know, where the money's going to come from.
Where is it going to come
from?
There
are 77 pages in this document. The government, the money is coming from the Exchequer. It's also coming from PPP engagement. It's also coming from the European Investment Bank.
How much is coming from PPP engagement, public-private partnership?
Well, there is a 500 million euro PPP engagement at one point in the document. There is another European Investment Bank co-funding project. But the bulk, and well, I emphasise this...
brings the figure down to 3.3
no,
only.
No,
so
sorry,
where is the rest of the 3.3?
There's 3.8 billion.
3.8, so 500 million brings it down to 3.3 billion. Account for the rest of the 3.3.
Billion coming from the Exchequer. The
Who's going to lose out then? Where is going to
the entire programme is going to be funded by government. Look, can I just make one point here?
But Aideen, with respect to you, you're trying to point out the detail to me when I ask you to flesh out the detail.
But you're looking for detail. You're looking for detail, but you're not willing to listen. You asked, was this a ramp up of the government's engagement in housing? And the bottom line is, it is.
I didn't.
Well, 2.2 billion was announced in the budget.
Aideen,
we have 3.8 billion today.
Please.
We have a 77-page document with a lot of very intense and rich detail.
Okay, so
tell me, please,
where the 3.3 billion is going to come
3.
from?
3.8 billion.
Okay, where is the 3.8? You already accounted for 500 million.
It's coming from the Exchequer.
Where is it going to lose out?
The Exchequer. That's the government. It's coming from the Exchequer over a period of years. And I'm sure, Alan, you'll want to say something on all of this, as other people will want to say, because we can dissect this document if that's what we're going to do tonight. But the bottom line of it is, we're going to be moving away from the traditional form of funding for social housing. It's long time that we did. We're the only country that I'm aware of in Europe where the government have paid for social housing upfront, 98% of it paid out of the Exchequer directly without levering the funding through other vehicles. We're going to move away from that because we have to, because we can't keep going on with the model that we have. We're going to go more towards the European style of funding for social housing. We're going to raise a certain amount of money off books, which is what we have to do,
okay,
given the restrictions
of the 110,000 units.
Yes.
Until 2020, 75,000 will be the private sector.
That's true. Private rent sector.
Yeah. Why is Labour, the Labour Party, depending on the private sector to provide social housing?
Okay. Well, let's put this in perspective. In 2008, the government built 7,000 to 8,000 social rented units, okay, out of an entire construction of 93,000 units, okay? This strategy between now and the end of 2017 is going to deliver 18,000 units. If you look at the maths of that, we are clearly looking at a very significant increase in the number of social housing unit developments. There's no two ways about that. This is a new development in our social housing. It's to be welcomed. There are 90,000 families on the housing waiting list waiting for a home, and this is a major development in the right direction.
Do you have any concerns?
I agree with Peter McFerry. I agree with Peter McFerry that there is a dependence on the rented sector in delivering some of this programme. 75,000 units over the entire life of the programme are going to be delivered through the private rented sector. Now, it's going to be delivered through HAP, which is the housing assistance payment, which basically means the rents will be paid by the state, which the kind of
issues... Do you have any concerns that the state is providing money to the private rented sector? And we learned today that 9 out of 10 of private rented accommodation doesn't meet the standard.
Well, can I just go back to the issue of rent? Rent increases are my big concern at the moment. I am very concerned about the number of people who are dealing with rent increases. And indeed, I've asked Alan Kelly to look at strategies to limit the level of rent increases. In other words, some level of rent control. With the housing assistance payment, rents will be paid directly by the state. So people who are in that scheme will have their rents paid directly by the state. So they will have the security of knowing. Now, in terms of substandard accommodation, that's a Dublin, the 9 out of 10 is an intensive inspection programme within the Dublin region. I'm not undermining that.
Do you have concerns about that?
Of course I have concerns nationally.
And should the state be spending money on substandard accommodation?
Oh, absolutely not. And if you look at my record...
Done then in this plan?
Well, look, here's the issue. You know, we have a system of housing that we've relied on the private sector. I personally am very critical of that. I don't believe we should be relying on the private sector, which is why I am welcoming today's announcement of 35,000 units.
But
yes,
it doesn't rectify this.
But I think you have to look at the positives in the document. There is a very big statement in here that we are going to develop a new programme for the private rented sector that's going to introduce new standards. And, you know, it's very clear in this document, the 77-page document, that it is accepted that there are limitations in the private rented sector and they're going to have to be dealt with.
Okay.
And that means new standards, it means rent certainty, and it means a really robust rented sector that people can live in.
OK, I'll come back to the private sector with Mark McSherry in just a moment. But Alan Barrett, do you have any concerns at all about the funding to be provided for this if the economy doesn't grow? If the money, as Aideen says, is to come from the Exchequer, if the economy doesn't grow as projected, could we see a problem?
Well, I mean, let's broaden it just beyond the narrow question that you've asked. It's actually, I've had today quite an interesting day in the sense that we're given this sort of policy initiative and we have to start thinking about it. And a number of years ago, of course, we were more used to this. It just sort of seems like such a long time since we've had a spending programme provided to us and we have to start thinking through whether or not this is a good idea. And I think in that sort of context, it's worthwhile going back to the way things are supposed to be done. Housing is an enormously complex issue. Homelessness arises for a whole complex web. Aideen knows an awful lot more about this than I do. But I think what struck me about today's announcement is everybody, of course, is going to welcome that there's going to be lots of new houses. I mean, there's a sort of a motherhood and apple pie dimension to this. Of course, that's to be welcomed. But I think the question really is, you know, has the level of deep thinking gone into this to look at the whole set of complex questions and to ask, for example, my understanding of sort of social housing problem, one of the issues was always about how do you design social housing so you don't necessarily have all unemployed and poor people together, that you get sort of social mix. I don't know if that sort of thinking is there. This is a capital programme. The Department of Finance had very, very rigorous requirements around any capital programmes in terms of evaluation, cost-benefit analysis. Mark kind of touched on this. The question, is this the least cost approach to it? So say, for example, there are all those unused homes around Ireland. Were they investigated? So you get a sense that there's a whole load of issues. They may or may not have been explored here, but I think, you know, it's important that we all go back to the sort of things we were supposed to be doing in terms of investigating.
Yeah.
Now, can I come to the macro?
Please do,
and
projected
issue?
Growth.
Yeah, look, let's forget about because that's uncertain. But what is worrying about this, and this actually sort of fits in with one of the things the Fiscal Council was talking about earlier in the week when we launched a report, and a bad week to do it given everything else that was being launched. But one of the things we're very, very concerned about
is... You've been gazumped by the government.
No, that's a scary thought. Anyway, looking ahead, the government, the most recent budget did provide a whole range of detail about how the public finances are going to evolve over the coming years. But one of the things the council picked up on is that there was an awful lot of technical assumptions. And so there's a sense you look ahead and the figures look all right, but it's all based on technical assumptions. What we worried about is that there seems to be a whole load of sort of spending pressures and spending commitments that weren't really explicit in the numbers. Now, we had talked in terms of, you know, over the coming years that there are these pressures. We didn't know within the week
that the, you know, these pressures were going to start coming about. If you read the document, there's a lot of sort of references to off-balance sheet expenditures and funding and everything like that. So that we'd have to go through a lot of detail. But to be honest, yeah, in the grand scheme of things, this did seem to sort of come out of nowhere. I think there are question marks over how it is going to be funded. And you asked the clear question, which is, well, if this is going to be funded, what has to
so is that
result?
Is that the professor's ladybird version of telling me that this funding model is on shaky ground?
Well, it's too late in the evening to try and get my head around your characterisation of Lady or whatever. But no, what I'm saying is that there are a whole range of, when you've a spending programme of this magnitude, you know, it's really important that we all think about every last detail of it. The thought may be there. I've sort of skimmed through the document. I'm not going to pretend I've gone through it in great detail. So maybe there's a huge amount of thought there, but you'd certainly worry that the sort of disciplines we had a number of years ago when we tried to start doing spending programmes well, I think some of that discipline simply may have evaporated.
Stephen Donnelly, would you share that worry?
Yeah, look, what'll matter a great deal is how the money is spent, and is there cross agency cooperation? Is there cross community body operation? So I've been involved in looking at it in Wicklow over the last few weeks, and on Friday last was at a forum in Bray where we had developers, we had council officials, we had voluntary housing bodies, we had politicians, we had a bunch of people whose job it is to try and sort this out. And there's a lot of very interesting opportunities. So one of the questions that I asked the council was, look, the government is about to sign a cheque for, at the time, 2.2 billion. We'll be looking for some of that for Wicklow. How much of that could you spend right now? I mean, how many houses could you actually build? And actually, how many houses do you want to build? How many types of, you know, one-bed apartments, three-bed semis, whatever it is? Do you know exactly how much you want to build? And what could you, this so-called shovel-ready idea? And the answer was, actually, we don't know exactly the mix of housing that we need in the various areas yet. So we don't have an exact baseline in place. And we very few shovel-ready products. Why? Because the hiring embargo over the last few years means that the technical staff in Wicklow County Council and probably in the local authorities all over the country haven't been replaced. So they don't actually have the people to say, right, we own this piece of land here. Let's get it zoned. Let's get the engineers in. But the voluntary housing bodies were there. The likes of Clwyd were there and said, well, actually, we do have those people. So if you have the land and you need technical staff, we have the staff. And if the government is going to put in the money, let's all get together and let's pool our expertise, pool our resources and build the houses.
So are you talking about a simple lack of joined up thinking then?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
Mark McSharry, is that the same in Sligo, along the Western Seaboard?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, many local authorities in the country, and this is an unwritten rule, I think, between among councils themselves rather than something that's directed by the Department of the Environment, they have a basic rule that they won't buy in a former council scheme. Maybe the theory there is that they don't want to, they want to get the appropriate social mix. But retrospectively, that's nigh on impossible. Whereas there would be much more competitive pricing in former council schemes all over the country. Then you have the amount of ones that are boarded up that I touched on earlier on. And this stock has substantially been ignored. The other thing, just to get back to the private sector, I mean, the reality is that rents are rising all over the country and surpass in most urban centres what councils are prepared to pay under the rules of the Department of the Environment in terms of the supports that are given to families. So, I mean, I think to suggest that the private sector will respond with 75,000 units from, you know, a rent that's going to be below market, I think it's highly optimistic. And I know Aileen knows this, but perhaps they should have got her to write the housing policy instead of whoever did.
I want Aileen to respond to your point. And also, I want you to respond directly to what Father Peter McFerry said today. He described this strategy as smoke and mirrors once again. Have a listen, and I want your direct response to him.
Now, there's a lot of smoke and mirrors going on here. We're not talking about 110,000 new housing units. 75,000 of these are going to be in the private rented sector. Now, the problem is there's a huge contradiction here that though people who want to get into housing can't get into the house, so into the private market sector at the moment. And those who are in are getting kicked out at a fierce rate because they can't afford to pay the rents. And yet this strategy says we're going to provide 75,000 housing units through the private rented sector. That does not stack up for me.
Does that, Aileen, not seem like an obvious pragmatic problem?
Well, look, for starters, I think we need to be looking at what the strategy actually says. The strategy says it will commit 35,000 additional social housing units, okay, and it says it will deliver another 75,000 through the housing assistance payment, which I've explained. The rents will be paid directly by the state through the private rented sector. So nobody is suggesting 110,000 units were going to be delivered through, you know, direct buy and build social housing. Nobody said that. And in fact, if you look at what the ministers, both Minister Kelly and Coffey actually said, that is exactly what it says. So I think, you know, Peter is extrapolating perhaps in terms of direct buy and build.
Can you address his point directly? He's saying that you're relying on the private sector to provide social housing payment. But he says there's a contradiction. People are being kicked out of private at a fierce rate. Would you agree with him?
No, I already said to you that one of the really good things about this project, this proposal, is that we are looking at the HAP, the housing assistance payment, which actually gets over some of the issues that Peter is talking about. He's talking about rising rents where people can't afford to pay them. Under the HAP, they won't be paid by the tenants. They will be paid by the state.
What if HAP isn't enough?
HAP will be enough to cover the rents. There are other issues which you raised
how
about
you
standards.
Know?
Well, because if the state is paying the rent directly, the state is paying the rent.
The state will pay 100% of the rent.
The state will be paying 100% of the rent.
Can I just explain about HAP?
I think it's a very important thing to understand. What happens with HAP is that the state pays directly and the tenant pays according to the tenant's means, which is what happens in social housing, as you would know, Mark, working directly on the ground with people
There's
in
a big
social
problem
housing.
Though, with it, isn't
but
there?
It basically means that it's a labour market activation measure, apart from anything else. It means that if I go back to work, I don't lose my rent supplement. I'm able to go back to work and keep my supports. And it's a really important measure for a lot of people out there. And, you know, I know Peter's very concerned about the level of rent rises, as I am myself.
Isn't the big issue with HAP security of tenure? So for those listening who don't quite know, I had to learn this stuff over the last few years. The greatest security of tenure you get is in a social house, right? Once you've got one, you've kind of got it for life. Unless you choose to downsize, you choose to go somewhere else. There is fantastic security of tenure. Then the government introduced this thing called RAS, the Rent Assistance Scheme, or
Rent Allowance Scheme.
Now, that provided less, but still a fair amount of security of tenure, which was 5 years. If the landlord said, yes, I'm willing to drop the rent, I think it was to 10% below the market rate, the council paid the rent, the landlord got 5 years of payments, and critically, the tenants. So the parents, the family got 5 years worth, not as good as being in a permanent guaranteed tenure, but still you can plan for the future. Aileen, my understanding is the problem certainly we're getting with HAP is it's year by year. So actually you can have your kids in a local school, you're in private rented accommodation for 1 year, but at the end of the year you may be told actually you've got to move on and there may not be a house near to the school. So for me the big issue with HAP is security of tenure.
Yeah. But Mark McSharry, if the state will pay 100% of the rent, surely it's a positive development.
Well, it's 100% of the rent that they'll choose. So I'm not sure that the market will respond to a level that the state determine. I think if it was at the current level and they went out and said, look, we want 75,000 units, I don't think that we'd get that produced.
I share Mark's concern.
You're an estate agent, you have experience of this. I do indeed.
I share his concern. I mean, I'm chair of a voluntary organisation that deals directly in the rental sector and I share your concern. I mean, I think we will have to go beyond.
Does that hole below the waterline then?
No, I mean, I think to be honest here, Cormac, I mean, we have to give credit where it's due in terms of what this strategy says. We also have to acknowledge its weaknesses and I know Mark's very sincere on the whole issue of housing. And, you know, we do have to acknowledge that there is an issue out there with supply and it will be a challenge for the state to find these units. There's no doubt about that.
OK, but Mark, you have experience of the way the market is right now and you have concerns then about HAP, do you?
Yeah, I mean, in Dublin, there's something of a recovery in terms of housing pricing and all of that. So So, and there is a major supply issue. But outside Dublin, provincial towns throughout the country, you have a scenario where there is housing stock available at quite a percentage below the cost of building. And I don't see the market responding to build housing to rent out at below market rents, effectively, in those areas. I think that's going to be a challenge. I mean, look, the problem with this, it's not the sincerity of Aideen at all in terms of her wish to see a solution to our housing problem nationally. The reality is, here is another policy announcement with lots of, frankly, woolly and honourable ambitions. But on what page of the 77 pages does it say how many houses in Sligo and where, how many houses for Baltinglass or Bray for Stephen, and indeed in your own area? And the reality is, I know without even seeing the document and reading it in the detail that you've had, that that's not there. And that's my concern.
I mean, I think that's not being fair to the document. It's 77 pages of detail. Yeah, and, you know,
what
particularly...
page is that on there?
No, but look, for starters, there's a Dublin Social Housing Delivery Task Force. Now, we all accept that a lot of the really serious issues are happening in Dublin. We don't have the same crisis in Sligo that we do in Dublin. We have 180 families in Dublin at the moment living in homeless accommodation in hotels.
There's
there is a serious effort here to address, you know, the issues that this country is facing. And I think we cannot forget the cost of the past. We have abandoned social housing in this country from literally the middle of the 1990s, and we're paying the price for it. Now, this document, I have to be fair, very fair to Minister Alan Kelly. He has really come out and said, we are going to tackle this problem. We are going to deliver 35,000 units of social housing in a very limited time frame.
But maybe the best way and most efficient way of tackling the problem
in social housing terms in a very long time
would be to increase rent supplement and to use the empty buildings that are available to local authorities now. And is that being done?
Yes, absolutely, it's been done. I mean, part of the 77 part of the 77 pages here is about addressing the issue of what we would call, what most people would see when they walk down the road in their local area, is boarded up social housing units. There's a major issue there with getting those back on track, and this document addresses that. In terms of the rent supplement, you know, this is a Department of the Environment document. Rent supplement is Department of Social Protection.
Oh, come on.
I wish they were the same. Look, I'm on the record.
Come on,
I'm on the record with Minister Burton day in and day out saying we must increase rent supplement limits. And we must.
In all seriousness,
we must increase rent supplement limits.
You cannot furnish that answer.
You know, Cormac,
this is a crisis.
Here's an issue.
This is a social crisis.
And
you're saying one department doesn't talk to the other.
I agree completely with you and with Mark and indeed with Peter that we must address the issue of rent supplement. I firmly believe...
But we can't because one department talks to the other. That's what you're saying.
I firmly believe that we need joint up thinking on the issue of housing, and I do believe it is a weakness that we have housing in two departments instead of in one. And if we go with the programme that's in front of us, we will have housing in one department, which I think is where it ought to be.
Did Alan Kelly ask you for your advice on this?
I've spoken to Alan Kelly on a number of occasions, as indeed has every single... In fact, if you look at the back of the document...
Did you make that point to him?
Vincent DePaul, Peter McVerry spoke to him. The Simon Community spoke to him.
And can
the National Federation of Voluntary Bodies spoke to him.
Can I ask you specifically, did you make that point to him about rent supplement?
I've made the point in rent supplement on a number of occasions.
Okay, and did he bring that point to Joan Burton?
I suspect and believe and I'm very confident that the minister is looking at the whole housing sector in a holistic way. I know that there are tensions between environment and social protection. There always have been. There's nothing new about that. One budget is one budget, another budget is another budget. And I agree with you, Cormac. It's whole of government thinking is what we need. And,
this is a Labour golden thread. You went to Alan Kelly. You asked him to increase rent supplement. He brought that to Joan Burton. She rejected that. Is that right?
No, Cormac, I think, first of all, you're underestimating me and you're underestimating Minister Joan Burton. I went to Joan Burton directly.
Okay.
And I asked her to increase rent supplement limits.
And what did she say to you?
We are waiting for a review of rent supplement limits, which we are expecting to get in the next couple of weeks, in fact.
Yeah. And is she amenable to increasing rent supplement?
We will have to wait and see.
Stephen Donnelly. Your question, Cormac, if I could say, goes right to the heart of how government, the civil service, fails the nation, right? We have this siloed behaviour and we have some very good things happening in both departments. But to Mark's point, Mark's question was, where within the document is the piece of thinking that says we need the following two bed apartments in Bray. We need the following number of three-bed semi-Ds in Arklow and in Tralee and in Killybegs and so on and so forth. Unfortunately, the way the state operates, which goes right to the heart of your question, is it starts from the state. It says, right, we're a department. How much money can we get? What are we going to do with that money? What we don't do and what we must learn to do in this country is plan from the citizen. Not from the state, from the citizen. How would you plan from the citizen in this perspective? You do the piece of analysis that says, here are the number and type and locations of families and individuals who need housing, be it emergency homeless accommodation or refuge or permanent accommodation or whatever it is, right? Here's where they live. Here's the projections for that. Here's the mismatch in supply and demand. And therefore, here's the amount of stuff we need to build or rent or buy, and therefore, here's the amount of money we're going to spend. That's what needs to happen. So your question goes right to the heart of what we need to get much better at over
okay,
the, next, over the coming
let's
years.
Listen to what people are saying about this. 51551, Barry says, the figures in this bill are fuzzy, off-balance sheet funding, etc., just like Irish water, he questions. Another texter, threshold have alienated landlords with their over-the-top outlawing of perfectly good bedsits, resulting in all but highly paid professionals being able to live on their own. And Martin says, Cormac, your Labour spokesperson avoided explaining how the Exchequer can afford this strategy. Would you ask again, please, Aideen?
I don't think the Exchequer has any option but to afford this strategy. If you look at where we stand at the moment...
Alan Barrett is laughing.
No, I'm not. I think this is a very serious issue.
I
would honestly say that housing is a major... It's in a major crisis, and it's a major crisis
for
this country.
That just leads to the simple question, what will you cut?
I mean, let's look at, you know, if you want to get into the detail here of, you know, what we
But when you make a point like you know, oh, this is so important, of course the state has to do that. I mean, you can say that about a whole range of things.
Yeah, well, I mean, look,
and again, it is one of the things that government decisions have to be made.
You know, you're on the Financial Advisory Council. You told us in 2014 that we should take 3.2 billion out of the budget. We took 2.5. We were right. You told us this year we should take 2.2 billion out of the budget. You're still telling us we'd take 2.2 billion out of the budget. We've had the lowest unemployment rate since 2009. I think, to be honest with you, you know, sometimes we actually understand more than pure economics about what's needed.
In terms of
housing, in terms of what we're going to cut, I think the budget was very robust in 2015, and the 2.2 billion that was in that budget was very robustly. I think Minister Brendan Hallin and Mr. McInerney were very clear on where that money was coming from. I don't think there is any issue in this strategy as to where the money is coming from. And you know, I think in terms of housing
I would like to answer that. In terms of the fiscal council's role, I mean, we see our role as being very much a long-term role here about protecting the sustainability of the public finances so that we actually, in the long run, do have the money to do the sort of things that you're talking about. So our mandate is about sound and sensible and prudent management. So as I said, it's for the long term, and I'd certainly stand over that. But there's no getting away from the fact that, you know, over the coming years, there will be, you know, budgetary constraints. You know, you can't wish that away. And when you're talking about very, very large amounts of money, I think there is an onus on politicians sitting around like just to sort of have a clear sense of where the money is going to come from. And I'm not asking that as a fiscal council member, as a citizen.
I mean, here's the thing.
I just want to know what is going to give.
Here's the thing. I mean, there's a 77-page strategy document here. You've acknowledged to me that you haven't read it in any great depth. So how are you criticising the government about where they're going to find the money when the detail of what they're planning to do is actually in the document?
Tell us, Aideen, tell us.
Look, the government are going to find the money in the way that they have declared that they're going to find the money, by prioritising housing. It's the
over
same...
Over what?
Over what do you mean? Over what? I mean, are you suggesting that we have a shopping list
I'm suggesting you outline, because
look,
social protection needs 19 billion, health needs around 13 billion or so, education needs almost 13 billion as well. I think who's going to lose out if we're to pump 3.8 billion into
3.8
housing?
Billion is being put into housing over a five year period
yeah.
for starters.
So where is it going to be found?
The 2.2 billion was set out in the budget already in 2015. The 2.2 billion has already been set out. out in the budget in 2015. The additional 3.8 has been set out in this document. It's going to be levered over a five-year period. And actually, the cost to us as a nation of not doing this in terms of homeless services, in terms of the cost to us as a community, is going to be even more severe. So I don't think there's any real issues as to how the money would be found. It's all in the document.
Okay,
I've got to chip in here.
Alan.
You know, I think we can all agree housing is enormously important, okay? But the worry is, over the next year, politicians from all parties are going to be sitting in rooms like this and making all sorts of suggestions about the importance of X, Y and Z. And again, I think this is both a fiscal council and a citizen concern. That, you know, over the next year, we'll hear a huge amount of this. It's not to take away from the importance of this particular issue, but next week it'll be an education discussion. The week after that, it'll be a health discussion. All of these absolutely critical areas of expenditure. Unfortunately, there are realities that we have to face, and the realities are still that even though the economy is growing, there are limits to what we can fund.
Do you
and
not
so
accept that we will be levering some of this money from the European Investment Bank? Do you not accept that we'll be levering some of this money through public-private partnerships? I mean, even just looking at a single project in Dublin City Council, for example, where there's a land bank, it's being levered to get money through the private sector. There are lots of ways in which the state can lever money.
You say a myriad
and
of ways.
One of the problems is that we've always done it by delivering 95% of funding for social housing. And we're unusual in European terms, and it's not at all unusual in the state borrowing to provide for housing, and that's what we're going to do.
A texter says, it makes no sense to reintroduce the tenant purchase scheme as a means of addressing homelessness. Tenants are already housed, and enabling them purchase their homes reduces the social housing stock. Spending should be concentrated on constructing additional local authority homes. David says, why are we handing responsibility for housing to charitable housing organisations? These houses can never be purchased or owned by their tenants, unlike council-owned houses. And another texter, a priest who was in touch to say, in the past few days, I've had five people with me, terrified, some to the point of suicide, rent going up, notice to get out pending with respect to aiding. For me, when it doesn't stack up for Father Peter McVerry, it doesn't stack up for me, he says. Well, Mark McSharry, we can go to a related topic now, because maybe the government will find money for the housing plan and other plans if the economy and jobs growth continues to grow, because the unemployment figures, as we learned today, are down to 245,000, just 11.1%. If this continues, if this pattern continues, if jobs continue to grow, and if there's a vibrancy in that sector of the economy, well, then that's very good news, is it not?
Well, definitely. I mean, any time that there are improved employment figures, it's definitely something to be welcomed and something to be built upon. A few points on them. Obviously, if you look at the demographic, the 20 to 34-year-old grouping is a huge part of it. We've had the immigration valve there. We have 75,000 people on activation schemes, job activation schemes. And the worry is that over 60% of the people are above the age of 35 that are in the longer term, over a year. They're more difficult to deal with. One of the things that I'd like to see is, have we established metrics on those 75,000 activation schemes, the various training schemes that are the Jobs Bridge ones, the ones that are operated through Solus and Foss and so on, have they been producing the outcomes that we wish for? There's a billion going into this area. Are we getting our bang for buck? I'm not so sure that we are.
Well, the government would say that we obviously are. We have a 10th, yeah. This is the 10th consecutive quarterly fall,
which is great news,
in the seasonally adjusted employment rate. So the government say that the proof is in the pudding.
Yeah, which is great news. No, the reason I'm saying this, I think we are the prize winners internationally at looking after the foreign direct investment sector. We're not the prize winners of looking after whether it's the super value or the local pub or the local factory in terms of providing the skill sets that they particularly need. So what I'd like to know is, could we be creating more jobs by specifically examining the job activation measures we have, these 75,000 places to see, are we training the right people? Are the 75,000 or the 50,000 of 2 years ago today employed by the sectors we train them for, or is there a gap in the market from which we could be deriving even more increases in employment?
But we're told today by the government that there are 100,000 extra people at work now compared to the first quarter of 2012, and that's when the action plan for jobs was launched. Now, all of that isn't foreign direct investment.
No. And nor am I saying it. I mean, the vast majority of jobs are created and kept by the SME sector. What I'm saying is, while the IDA are doing a great job, do we need to do more to support the SME sector to get more jobs in? Now, then you get into the whole area of the availability of credit and indeed the cost of credit, which are two areas that I don't believe we're doing enough with. Obviously, there is the issue there with schemes like the credit guarantee scheme and the microfinance scheme, both of which have operated well below the target set by the government. I would favour the re-establishment of an ICC-type situation, financed by the $2.5 billion, which we've discovered this week is just sitting in cash.
But Fine Gael and Labour say this is Fianna Fáil clutching at straws, and because the news is so good, you have to clutch at something.
Not at all. I welcomed and agree with you on the good news, and credit where credit is due. But if you think that it's a matter of just of action since 2012 that led to that, I mean, the regaining in competitiveness and so on goes back to 2008 and taking 20, 25 billion out of the economy, which sadly caused an awful lot of pain. But what we must do is, you know, we're not pushing the boat out far enough in the context of making money available. And just
okay, is he right, Alan Barrett?
Well, Mark, I mean, he's made a whole range of points there.
On that, are we making enough credit available, and are we massaging this small and medium enterprise sector enough? Is enough being done in that regard?
Well, I think certainly for quite a long time over the sort of the period of the recession, I think one of the great concerns was the twin track economy, and I think this is essentially what Mark is focusing on. That there was a very vibrant international sector, the foreign direct investment type companies, and the domestic sector was essentially flat. Really, what the domestic sector in Ireland needs to be doing well is that domestic demand is growing. This is consumption in particular. There is signs now that that is sort of kicking into gear. The ESRI has been looking at issues of small and medium-sized financing, enterprise financing, for quite a long time. If you go back a number of years, the issue of access to credit was the critical issue facing these sort of companies. It's still on the list of concerns that they have, but it's not anything as high as it was a number of years ago. And they are turning their concerns now. They're more focused on customers and expanding. It's really those sort of issues.
Is it turning that much so? Because when you talk to small business owners around the country, they say, look, I'd love to expand, I'd love to hire somebody else, but I can't get the money to do it.
There are very, very different SMEs. Okay, and I think what the research shows is that for SMEs that have legacy debt, they are still in a very, very difficult position. For other company, it's not as bad. So, you know, to talk about them as a single entity probably misses it. So there's quite a spectrum. The one additional point that I'd like to make about the employment figures today is they do highlight this sort of disconnect that's going on at the moment, though, between what's happening in terms of employment numbers and the growth numbers for the economy in general. So just simple terms, the employment is now growing on an annual basis by 1.5%. Okay, but the economy seems to be growing by about 4.5%. Okay, so that's quite a disconnect. Okay,
like why is that happening?
Well, one of the issues that's floating around in the National Accounts at the moment is this strange phenomenon called contract manufacturing. Now, I'm not going to bore you to death by explaining it, but basically, it's this situation in which you have Irish resident companies, they're not necessarily Irish owned, but companies that are resident in Ireland that have activities that are based abroad. And what we've noticed in the National Accounts is that the activity abroad is sort of counted as part of the Irish National Accounts, and it seems to have increased a lot in recent times. Now, you know, there's a question mark over, you know, are we observing an increase because the CSO are measuring this more intensively? Is there genuinely something going on? Might it unwind? But there is a sort of an unusual situation here that, and the Department of Finance are quite open about it, and they wrote about it in the budget booklet, but it does suggest again the sort of nervousness the really good growth figures on the one side. You compare that to the employment, like 1.5% employment growth is good, but it's not amazing.
Okay, so you're worried about Stephen Lonnie. Other people raise other questions about growth and jobs and jobs being created. It's the type of job that is being created. Are they jobs with decent salaries and decent conditions, or are they all low paid?
Yeah, it's a good question, Cormac. And it seems from the numbers we got today from the CSO that the answer is a bit of both. So for the man and woman listening, the number of jobs out there has gone up. It continues to go up, and that's great. It's a mixed bag, though. So, for example, female unemployment is falling in the latest figures at half the rate of male unemployment. Now, male unemployment went up an awful lot higher than female unemployment. But Michael Noonan and I were discussing this in committee recently enough, whereby Male unemployment, thank goodness, has come down significantly over the last while. Female unemployment hasn't. It's kind. It's beginning to tip down a little bit, but it went up and it kind of stayed up. We see from the figures that a lot of the increase in employment is construction. Obviously, that's a heavily male-dominated sector. So there's a lot more can be done. We now finally have one woman in the Economic Management Council. But I have said to Michael Noonan before that my concern is that the budgets probably haven't been as balanced as they could be. So, for example, making childcare affordable would create job activation more towards women, turning maternity leave into parental leave, focusing on sectors other than the construction sector. Obviously, there's been an awful lot of focus on the construction sector. Long-term unemployment, as Mark said, is still a big problem. But we've got two fantastic assets. Sorry, we've got three fantastic assets. We've got Enterprise Ireland and the IDA, which anytime I'm talking to people here and abroad in the business community, Enterprise Ireland and the IDA are held up around the world as two of the as absolute best practice. They're doing a phenomenal job and they deserve an awful lot of credit for an awful lot of what's happened. We've the LEOs now have been set up. What we also have is the Indigenous SMEs. And when you talk to the business owners, they will tell you about the lengths that they go to not fire people and to keep people on over the recession. And there has been some quite extraordinary and fantastic solidarity. Now, there is much more opportunity. I believe that the focus is too much on new jobs, or rather new enterprises. So Enterprise Ireland is about new companies, and the IDA is about kind of bringing multinational companies in. The LEOs, the local enterprise offices, are about new companies, and there's grants and there's all sorts of things for new companies.
So there should be more focus where?
On existing companies. So the sector that I don't think is getting enough attention, and there's lots of room to help more, is the existing SME sector. So, for example...
Oh, okay, I know Mark McSherry. I'll hold your example for a second, because I know Mark McSherry wants to get in on this as well. You've been nodding your head there. You agree, you're in agreement.
Oh, I was agreeing with that, and that's the point in effect that I was making. You know, are we giving enough support? We're brilliant at the Enterprise Ireland IDEA stuff. Are we as good, or can we get better at the SME end of it? I think we can, and I think we'll have quicker wins and bigger wins in that regard. Just on credit specifically, I think that we have two pillar banks here now, no competition in effect, and we have a lending underwriting strategy that is completely risk adverse. We have the Strategic Banking Corporation, to much fanfare, announced a month ago. That's just going to be a wholesaler from European money to the pillar banks, who will still have the same underwriting policy. So we're still having this adverse scenario. Yes, the SME, who doesn't, as Alan said, have major other debts to do with property acquisitions or something like that, can get money at the moment. But who's been told by a bank to come in, give us that idea? We're 80% sure, but I tell you what, we're going to give you that money because we think you could succeed. And I don't believe enough of that is happening.
Let's tie two stories here now, Aideen, because they say that, the panellists say that the problem, there should be more focus on existing companies, and existing companies need credit from banks or the credit unions or wherever to hire people and expand. But maybe the governor of the central bank, Patrick Holohan, before an electives committee today, gave a hint as to why that isn't happening, because he was asked about residential mortgages and the variable interest rates being charged by the banks, and he was asked by Michael McGrath of Fianna Fáil if they were too high, and his response was, it's a bit on the high side, but the banks cannot fund themselves at ECB rates. So basically, are Irish banks charging the customer through the nose because they need to plug a hole in their own balance sheet? And can the same point be made in terms of giving credit to small business? They're not going to give credit because they need to plug a hole in their own balance sheet. They need to shrink their own balance sheets. And if that is a problem, how is the government letting the banks get away with that?
Well, first of all, I have to say, Governor Patrick Holohan, I really admire him for his honesty. And both Mark and I have been, you know, witness to him on the Finance Committee before Mark was elevated onto the banking inquiry. And he is. He shoots from the hip and he says it as it is. And I have a huge amount of time for that. And yes, he was very honest and quite brutally honest in saying that for example, because banks are dealing with, you know, a legacy tracker mortgage issue that they're in his view, you know, insofar as he was blunt about it, they're making up the deficit by on the variable rates, and the, you know, that he was quite clear on that.
Are they screwing the customer to plug their own holes?
Well, you know, look, you know, he would say, and he is the governor of the central bank, so his job, and I would, I sometimes wish he was a bit more robust on things like mortgage arrears and other issues that I've raised with him. So I would prefer he shot more from the hip, so to speak. But I do understand that he is the governor of the central bank, and he does actually have a particular mandate, and that is in relation to the banks. But, you know, he was pretty clear that there, you know, there's a certain amount, you know, and he didn't use these terms, these are my terms, profiteering on variable rate business
in order to
sustain tracker rates. And you know, there's a certain amount of truth to all of this in terms of, you know, who's paying the price, the legacy price for the disaster that happened to this economy. And the ultimate point about it is banks are trying to repair their balance sheets, and they're doing it, in my opinion, in whatever way they can.
But they've got billions of euro from the taxpayer already. Now they're crucifying the ordinary punter, the ordinary customer, to plug holes in their balance sheet again. How can that be fair?
Well, they're going to argue. I mean, four of them came before the Finance Committee last week, and they're going to argue, you know, robustly that that's not the case, and that they're doing, you know, what they can do, and they're being proactive in terms of their mandate. You know, ultimately, at the end of the day, a certain amount of this, and I'm saying this as somebody who comes from government, comes down to government. You can't always expect the banks to it's not their particular mandate to support certain types of activity, and we have to look at maybe how we're going to change the banking system. I mean, Governor Hohenheim himself said it today. He actually said, you know, maybe we need something between the credit union movement and the banks that we...
But that's not on the government's agenda, is it?
Well, maybe it's something that needs to be on the government's agenda. And, you know, Patrick Hohenheim, to be fair to him, has raised a number of very significant issues over his term as governor of the central bank, not least his statements before the banking crisis, as Mark will know. And he is somebody, as I said, who shoots from the hip. And he said, okay, yes, maybe the answers don't all lie with the pillar banks and the banking.
Okay, well, look, we're looking for answers. Also, Mark McSharry from Europe and the ECB and the banking inquiry. And Governor Patrick Honan was asked by this, by a colleague of yours, I think Thomas Byrne today as well. He said, look, can you convince Mario Draghi or members of the ECB to come to our banking inquiry and ask questions? And he basically said, no. Not really.
Yeah, clearly he doesn't have a ground. As it's an international body, they are free to from the strengths of compellability here. I think it would be it should be demanded nationally by the government, and indeed with the help of some of the alliances that exist on other issues throughout our European friends, to impress upon the ECB and indeed the other institutions of Europe that the Irish people, particularly given the publication of recent letters from the ECB, feel that there is quite a number of unknowns in terms of the role played by Europe in the demise of Irish people, and in particular the prescription of the medicine to deal with the crisis. And I think that people are entitled to those answers.
But Stephen Donnelly, if they can't be compelled, is this a sideshow then?
No, I don't think it's a sideshow. I think there's a very serious case for Jean-Claude Trichet to appear. We all knew that that letter that got published a few weeks ago was going to contain some sort of threat in terms of saying, look, you need to lock yourselves into a troika deal. But it went much, much further than that. Trichet, in his letter, demanded that Ireland engage in structural reforms. Now, what does that mean? Well, about 4 weeks later, the first document was signed with the troika, and it only had two structural reforms in it. One of them was Irish water. So I absolutely agree that Trichet is under no legal obligation. We can't compel him to come, but the government at the very highest level, at the level of Enda Kenny, should be making it very clear, very publicly, that we do need Trichet to come and answer
questions. But even if they do, Alan Barrett, even if they do say that time and again, is it likely to happen?
which that
outcome. That the ECB will come and answer questions at our banking inquiry?
No, I think it's highly unlikely that they will. And I would imagine one of the issues here, they are central bankers who are not used to sort of being in the sort of forum. It may be the case that as the inquiry sort of develops, that it will come across as a sort of very calm, cerebral type of exercise. But I've no doubt that these guys are not that excited about being in front of Joe Dickinson. I don't mean to sort of specify Joe, but you know, they don't know yet how this thing is going to operate, how it's going to look. And, you know, they're not parliamentarians.
Mark?
The only thing I would say about that, if for some reason there was a committee within the German parliament, which required for any reason that Governor Honohan would attend at their committee, I can assure you that pressure would come to bear from other member states and he would be there. And I believe the same should happen for us.
Patrick Honohan did say that he himself would attend and he would give a full account.
Of course, I'm not talking about him.
No, I know that. He said he knew a lot, and I took this down because I was quite fascinated by it at the time. He said he knows the answers. So he was indicating that even if, you know, Trichet wasn't going to be there, he himself could fill in a lot of the
gaps.
Okay,
well, we'll wait and see. Can I ask Stephen Donnelly, finally, are you going to a party tomorrow night? Have you been invited to Lucinda Creighton's new political party? Isn't that happening tomorrow night? You didn't get an invite.
I have no idea what's happening tomorrow
night. By God, he has no idea, everyone. He hasn't been invited to the party. Oh, you're going to Shane Ross's party, is that right?
I haven't been invited to any parties. No, look, Cormac, I was elected as an independent TD by the people of Wicklow and East Carlow. I have worked very hard as an independent TD for the people of Wicklow and East Carlow and for the nation. That's what I'm doing. Obviously, in my role, I'm considering what options may be available in the future. It is not helpful for anyone for me to pontificate out loud. Right now, I'm doing my very best as Wicklow's only and East Carlow's only independent TD. I hope I'm doing a good job for them. And obviously, as with any elected representative, I'm considering the future.
The report said she was trying to have a discussion for a new political party to bring honesty and integrity back into Irish politics. And you didn't get an invite, Stephen Donnelly. What does that say about you?
I don't know. I must be Billy No-Mates, Cormac, you know.
Okay, well, we'll see which party you'll turn up at. Okay, we'll leave it there. A quick look at tomorrow morning's Irish Daily Star. Big TV exclusive, they say. Kinahan sidekick axed from RTE reality show. Hours of footage chopped. And the other headline on that paper. Dubai prison man, I'll be home this Christmas, he says. Muwechas Mershinla, Stephen Donnelly, Alan Barrett, Aideen Hayden, August Mark McSherry, Bumjanashirish, Amorach, Agajechalog, Gajishin, Kulasov.